Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the Professional Book Nerds podcast presented by Overdrive. Before we get into today's episode, remember to rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Those ratings really mean a lot to us, and they help us get seen by more folks just like you. You can follow us on social media. We're at ProBookNerds on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And you can email questions, comments, or suggestions for future episodes to our email, professionalbooknerds@overdrive.com. With that, my guest today is the internationally best-selling author of The Watchmaker of Filigree Street, The Bedlam Stacks, The Lost Future of Pepper Harrow, The Kingdoms, and The Half-Life of Valerie Kay. She has won a Betty Trask Award, been shortlisted for the Authors Club Best First Novel Award, the Royal Society of Literature's Encore Award, the Wilbur Smith Adventure Writing Prize, and has been longlisted for the Walter Scott Prize. Coming to us from Bristol, England to talk about her new book, The Mars House, it's Natasha Pulley. Natasha, welcome. Thanks so much for being here.
Oh, hi. Thanks so much for having me. It's such a pleasure.
Of course, listeners, Natasha is joining us from Bristol. So we've got a little bit of a time delay. While my day is only a few hours in, you're probably at the end of your day. How has your day been?
It's been lovely. I'm actually at about 3 o'clock here. So it's not Wednesday.
To me, that's the end of the day. That's when like I'm clocking out and I go to real life.
Oh, that's really, really good. I think I've got this weight training session at the gym that I'm kind of gearing up to. So I feel like I haven't started properly yet.
Oh gosh, weight training. I mean, we'll test your brain muscles. We'll get those working first. And then hopefully,
let's do that.
Yeah, hopefully you'll be in the place to lift heavy things around.
Amazing. Yes.
To get us started, could you tell the listeners about the Mars House?
Absolutely. So this is a very new book for me because I've actually never written science fiction before. I usually do historical fiction that's sort of very UK based. And for the first time, I have set something on Mars. So you can imagine how not in any way delighted my agent was when I handed her this book and went, it's set on Mars. It's about Mars. But yeah, so the book follows a British man called January and what happens to him when a climate catastrophe on Earth sees him flee his normal life in London to become a refugee on a new colony on Mars. Now, he's quite an interesting person, I say, having written him. He's the principal dancer for the Royal Ballet. But when he gets to Mars, he's only allowed to do manual labor work and he's only allowed to live in very restricted places in a kind of very restrictive way within the city. And this is because to people from Mars who are born in much lower gravity, people from Earth are kind of inhumanly strong and therefore very, very dangerous. And in fact, in the book, the highest cause of death for Mars-born people in the city is that someone from Earth accidentally kills them. So a lot of the politics in this place hinges around immigration from Earth. Earth is burning, so should people from there be allowed to come to Mars? Where? Every so often they'll accidentally kill someone. The current consul, who's like the president, says definitely yes, they're super pro-Earth. But a massive election is coming up. It's like the presidential election. And the consul is running against a fire-breathing nationalist called Aubrey Gale. And Gale says the opposite. The borders should be shut. No more people from Earth. When Gale does a set of campaign publicity interviews live at the water factory where January now works, January and Gale clash like completely disastrously. And this is for both of them. The only way out for the credibility of Gale's campaign and for January's future on Mars, like if he wants to avoid being deported, is an arranged marriage. And the rest of the book is about how they make that work and how they kind of screw it up quite a lot along the way. And there's also some mammoths, which I think is cool.
Talk about a surprise for the mammoth reveal.
Oh, yeah.
Things that like don't even exist on Earth for hundreds of years. And then surprise, they're on Mars. And they might
I was
talk.
Just like, you know what? If I were a scientist and, you know, I've met scientists, they're all wonderful. If I were a scientist and I was working in a very cold weather environment and I wanted to create the flora and fauna of this new cold weather environment, I would resurrect mammoths.
You'd be going the Jurassic Park route. Let's bring back some old cold friends.
Yeah, why not have giant fluffy elephants if you can?
If the technology is there for me to live on Mars and bring back extinct creatures, the mammoths are coming back.
Yes.
I mean, also probably a saber-toothed tiger just so I could like see it in person, but then also that's a risk. So like not more than one, but you know.
That's really good. One really lonely saber-toothed tiger.
I mean, like, yeah, that's just like my own wish fulfillment. And I know that's terrible just to think of, like one really lonely one. Right, exactly. But like, I don't know if you could. But then the thought of like, oh, I just released this killing machine into our society of basically like vegan people who are weakened and because of gravity. I mean,
yes, and yeah, chaos will assuredly ensue.
You know, so. Different. I'd be taking things in a slightly different plot point, apparently.
Yeah, definitely. But, you know, I put the mammoths in there to prove that this isn't all like political doom and gloom. There is joy also.
Yes. And so that makes me think of two things right away. Number one, this shift to sci-fi for you is huge. I mean, I think of The Watchmaker of Filigree Street, and then I think of this and I'm like, well, I see how the same person wrote them, but what a jump to go from that kind of like magical realism, historical fiction in the UK to sci-fi. What inspired you? How did this come about? And what made you stick with it being so different from your usual?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a really wonderful question. And I think for people who've read my previous work, it's going to feel like this kind of massive leap. In reality, it's actually me going back to when I was a child and how I was educated and how I was raised. So something that is going to make sense of this book a lot, I think, is if I explain like my school and where I went to school. So I'm from a school in Cambridgeshire in the UK, and Cambridgeshire is called Cambridgeshire because Cambridge is in it, as in University of. And in Cambridgeshire, staffed by scientists from Cambridge, there is an astronomical observatory. And my school, I believe, was the only high school in the country to offer astronomy as a subject for teenagers to study.
Oh, wow.
And so I started studying astronomy, I think, when I was 13. And then I did exams in it when I was, I think, 16. This is the normal age that we do exams in the UK. So essentially, I went to Hogwarts and I did astronomy. and it was the most incredible schooling I've ever had. Like otherwise, my school was very ordinary. And, you know, we had to study math and we had to study boring stuff that I didn't like business studies. And I did Latin. I have exams in Latin.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's how I sound. But astronomy was incredible. And so a scientist came from Cambridge to take us out in the night with telescopes and look at the moons of Jupiter. He also brought, and this is what stuck with me, and this is where this novel comes from, he brought to our science lab a prototype of the Beagle probe. Now, depending on how old your listeners are, they may or may not remember the Beagle probe, but it was one of the earliest, I think in fact it might have been the first probe to land on Mars. And when I say land, I mean in a really loose sense, it kind of fell on Mars. In those days, and we're talking like 20 years ago, they didn't know what the gravity was like or what the surface was like. So there was no way to like gently land a probe on Mars. You just kind of had to drop it and hope it didn't smash And so the Beagle probe was designed to basically drop from space onto the planet.
And survive.
Yeah, survive. It was a pretty amazing thing. And I had a prototype of it on my science room floor when I was 15 years old. And this thing is amazing. It looked like a kind of quite large yellow box, but it opens out kind of like flower petals, and it's quite big. And it really, really stuck with me that an early prototype of this thing that actually went to Mars was on my crappy science room floor. What the scientists said about the gravity and how they didn't know how this thing was going to land or if it would even survive the fall really stuck with me. And I started to get very, very interested in gravity. And I was watching tons of sci-fi. I grew up on like Star Wars and Star Trek and all the other weird but great stuff that was on TV, for when millennials were young. And it was fascinating. But one of the things that was hardly ever addressed was gravity. It was just really interesting to sit down and go, oh, but what about gravity? Because different worlds have different gravities and they do wildly different things to humans. And a lot of the science of what it does to humans doesn't really exist yet because we haven't gone far enough out. So there's some studies of, you know, humans in zero G and plants in zero G, and they're really, really interesting and kind of scary. But we don't honestly know what will happen when we put humans on Mars. I think what we do know is that it's going to be very, very difficult and not at all kind of utopian and wonderful in the way that we kind of want to think when we watch stuff like Star Trek. And I wanted to write about that for a long, long, long time.
It makes sense how you got there. And this interest in science, did you find some of that joy again when you were kind of formulating your science and any research that you did in the process to create it in the book?
Yeah, I mean, so I've always loved science. If I hadn't gone into kind of writing books and the arts, I would have gone into physics and astronomy. I really, really love it. And yeah, so I mean, like, so I've always researched a lot of science for the books. And the one that I'm most proud of is the one previous to this, which is about a nuclear disaster in Russia. And I did an undergraduate course on nuclear physics for that book.
Well, of course you would have had to, like, yeah. that level of knowledge.
I mean, I'm still garbage at nuclear physics.
But you had to put yourself through it
to
get
study,
there.
And it's remarkable. I've always loved science. I particularly always loved physics. I know that there's going to be some science that is wrong in the Mars house. And that's because I'm not a physicist as much as I wish I were.
As much as you may want to be in the sciences, you know you're not.
I am in fact not. I teach creative writing at a liberal arts university. That's what I do with my life.
But also, as you said, like the effects of gravity, we know so little. Like before reading this, the only thing I was truly aware of was just the idea of like, if you go into space, you get some spinal decompression, you're gonna get taller. Like, great. And then we see that play out. We also see the impacts that you've kind of created for the native born Mars folk to have grown taller, to be weaker compared to Earth counterparts because of the lack of resistance in Mars gravity. Also the concepts of like mining for water and how energy is created. I mean, all of these different things. Basically, what I'm saying is world building.
Ah, yes. That's fun. World building is always fun.
Right. And like, I'm recognizing that the words I'm looking for is just world building. How did you go about your world building? Because you have to like dip your toe in the facts that we have, but you also have like the beautiful joy of the word fiction. So what was world building like for you?
Honestly, joyful and completely chaotic, because I think if you're so if you're not a scientist, you're often not aware of what you don't know. So it's the first thing you have to do is find out what you don't know and like put a ring fence around it and say, oh, this is what I need to find out. This is what's possible. This is not what's possible. The second thing you need to do, and this is often really tricky and you need to do it with any field that you study seriously, is what do we generally not know? Where, like, what do even the super professionals, the geniuses, not know. And often it's surprising how much is just not known, or how much is theoretical, but we're just not in a position to test it yet. So one of my favorite things that I researched was, how do you generate enough solar power on Mars? Because it's much further away from the sun than Earth is. So the amount of ground you would have to cover with solar panels in order to get a significant amount of energy from the sun on Earth is actually quite small. I think I'm right in saying that if you covered something like the area of Alabama with solar panels, you would be able to power the entire United States.
Now I'm just lost in the thought of that.
In fact, it's probably less than that. But it's really fascinating. There are different kinds of solar panels that will function differently. And it's really, really interesting. So Mars gets less sunlight. So I spent a lot of time trying to look at, well, how efficient are solar panels and how much ground would they have to cover to do this? And that was really fun. The other thing that I loved was, what about backup power? Because Mars gets dust storms and it's real cloudy sometimes. So this is a problem. If your solar panels are your main source of power.
If they get dusty, what are we going to do?
What are we going to do? Exactly. So one of my favorite things that I found out about, these are real things. They're called gravity trains. And essentially what you do is you drop something heavy from a height and then hike it back up again. It's a system of storing potential energy. So when you hike something up to a height and then let it come down again, the power generated by the friction of it coming down generates heat, right? Which is power. And I thought, this is great to import onto Mars, because one of the amazing geographical features of Mars, and I don't know how much you know about Mars. I'm sure you read about it in the bath like a normal person.
You're right. I mean, I saw The Martian.
I'm sure all your listeners read about Martian topography in the bath as well.
We do. It's a requirement.
I'm really glad. So you will know, therefore, that on Mars, there is a very, very, very deep valley. And it runs, if you look at a map of Mars, it's this kind of huge slash that runs, I think it's slightly north of the equator on Mars. And it's about 4 miles deep. And this is a real thing. It's the Mariner Valley, I think named after the Mariner probe. And so I thought, well, you know, if you put a gravity train at the top of that and then let it sink, even in Martian gravity, that's quite good, right? I spent quite a lot of time looking at numbers and going, well, how much energy could you actually generate doing this given Martian gravity? And my sums are probably wrong, but I think they look sort of convincing in the book if you are not in any way a specialist. So that's what's there.
But the other thing is, like, you have sums, right or wrong. I'm still just thinking about, like, that loop of potential energy. So you did math. That to me is already like, well, I trust you more than I trust myself.
You shouldn't. I'm pretty sure I did really bad math.
That's all I do is really bad.
That was really fun. Like all the aspects of that, the kind of the science stuff, even though I'm almost certain that it's wrong, were hugely joyful.
Looking at other parts of your world, of course, we have the class divide. We have the culture divide. We've got kind of the sectioning off. I'm thinking of, like, it's so funny to see something called America Town in a story. Like,
yeah.
Yes, of course it makes sense. But aside from thinking of, like, the 150 plus year jump, the political intrigue of this novel, where did that come from? And building that into your story, what made that key? Because it's what feeds so well into this kind of, like, marriage of convenience tale.
Yeah. So I think when you read this book, you can really badly tell that I'm British and writing at a time when about half of Britain decided that it didn't want to be part of the European Union anymore. And this is, I know, like, Americans are probably very tired of hearing Brits talk about Brexit. If you've ever heard us talk about it, once is too much. Yeah, I mean, you'll hear me talk about it now and then you'll just go away and go, I never want to hear anyone British talk about anything again. It's, in some ways, it's deeply boring. Essentially, we were part of a trading bloc. that is Europe for a long time. And then for reasons that are still unclear to me, we decided that it would be a great idea to leave. And the consequence is that life here is significantly worse than it used to be. I think for anyone who is British, and I think actually I'm sure for anyone who is American, immigration is going to be a thing that is on the mind for at least the last 5 years. Brexit happened in, I think, this is a weird thing about my life. I had just moved to Peru. I was on a research trip. I was like, I will now live in Peru. And I did. And I was in an elevator in Lima. And a man, Peruvian man, took one look at me. I had not spoken a word. I wasn't holding up a sign that said British person. He took one look at me and he was like, Brexit? I was like, yeah. He went, I'm so sorry.
And that's how it goes.
And that's how it goes, yeah. So the political situation on Mars is, it boils down to, do we want to help millions of desperate immigrants, or do we not want to help them because we consider them to be extremely dangerous? And that is essentially the debate that a lot of European countries have all the time. And I think it's also a debate that is very current in the US. The demonization of immigration and immigrants is a serious business. But likewise, people have very valid concerns about it, about immigration. And so where does that go? How do you talk about that? So that was certainly something that informed the book. And I was just also very interested in, why are people afraid of other people? And what are these power dynamics? How are you powerful? What makes you powerful? Is it being physically strong? Is it being physically scary? Or is there this bunch of other stuff that makes you strong and powerful? So it does all kind of boil down to, I'm British in a time when immigration was the leading issue of the day. What I would say as well is, it's very easy to read science fiction as an allegory, right? You say, oh, but what's it really about? Oh, is it really about Brexit? Is it really about Trump? Is it really about, you know, Israel or this or that or the other? My answer is always no. It is like some of those things, but it isn't really about any of them.
I think you can see the true connection to, like, the human condition when you look at January, because in the beginning of the story, as we're seeing January being taken from flooded London, where he's, as you said, the principal in London, going to this world where now he works in a mine. And then you learn that there is a way that you can be naturalized, and you're thinking, like, oh, why would this person not want all of the benefits that are afforded to them? And of course, you hear the risks, you hear them here and there. And it's not until that kind of first conversation with Gail that you hear that, like, oh, he doesn't want to lose his previous life. If he's naturalized, it's very likely that he'll never have the strength to dance again.
The idea in the book is that if you as a person from Earth move to Mars, you then wear this thing that they called a cage, which is like it just resists your movement so that it brings you down to normal strength for Mars. They have this concept, which is naturalization, which is that you take the cage off, you go to what's essentially a hospital for about 3 months, and just let your body naturalize to Martian gravity. Realistically, health-wise, this would be pretty catastrophic. You would never be able to regain your strength, and you would never be able to go back to Earth. Because at that point, if your heart isn't used to lifting, say, 3 times the normal weight that it's currently lifting on Mars, you'd have a heart attack and die as soon as you came into Earth's atmosphere. So this is a very permanent immigration solution for them. So January has always decided to not do this. So he was a dancer. So his whole sense of identity and purpose really hinges on his physicality and his strength and the fact that, you know, that's what he spent his entire life doing. But the other kind of broader thing is, when you assimilate into another culture, how much of your own culture can you reasonably be expected to excise from yourself and leave behind? I've never, like, completely uprooted and just gone to live forever in another country, but I have lived in 3 different countries. I've lived in Japan, Peru, and China. So I would say living in Peru is very, very easy, kind of culturally. Like, Hispanic culture is very, very close to kind of European Western culture. I had no problems. In Japan and China, though, And I spent this last summer in Shanghai. So this is vividly in my memory. It's recent. Not only do you look different. So in Peru, there are plenty of people who look like me, like maybe not quite as pale blue as I am, but you know, I could be Peruvian, and I speak Spanish now with like a Lima accent. So if I was speaking relatively well and I was feeling pretty fluent, you wouldn't immediately guess that I was British. And so I would blend in. Like I could use the bus and I didn't feel weird. In Shanghai, I would be the only person who looked like me in the entire railway station. And Shanghai is actually a really metropolitan place. Like they're really used to foreigners. But when I walked down one of the main roads in Shanghai, which is kind of towards the river, and it's just this really beautiful shopping avenue, it's gorgeous. We don't have anything like it in Britain, which is a trash fire, but I'll just leave that to the side. I was walking down this main road and this lady like grabbed me and took a selfie with me it's very, very difficult to function at all in Shanghai if you have no Mandarin. And fortunately, I was at Mandarin school. So by the end of like a month, I could talk to people and that was fine. And then life was a lot easier. But there are things about yourself that you have to change a lot. And there are things that are very culturally typical to your country that you can't really take with you. And this is less so in China, but in Japan, the main thing is sense of humor. Like, so as I'm sure you know, British people have a very particular sense of humor and it tends to hinge on irony. In Japan, that's just rude. Sarcasm is rude. To disagree is rude, even though that is the natural state of most British people, to just disagree with whatever the person had said to them last. And I was working at a university. I remember being in a room and the lecturer who I was working for, I was a teaching fellow.
Hi there. I'm Heather Drago.
And I'm Sarah Saunders.
We host the podcast, That's a Hard No, about saying no and setting boundaries.
So you can become that true and empowered you that this world needs. Saying no isn't just okay.
It's the key to living an authentic, fulfilling life.
I'm a licensed professional clinical counselor. So while this podcast is in no way a replacement for one-on-one therapy, I suppose I know what I'm talking about.
I'd say so. We talk about learning to say no and set healthy boundaries and how it impacts mental health, physical health, relationships, parenthood, and more.
Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and visit our website, hardnopodcast.com.
We're here to help you find your no and say it unapologetically.
That's a hard no.
You know, a lot can happen in 7 minutes, and luckily, that's how long it takes me to tell a story. My name is Aaron Califato, and I'm the creator of 7-Minute Stories. I'm proud to partner with Evergreen Podcasts, and I'd like to invite you to join me on this journey. I'm going to take you on some crazy roller coaster rides using my unique extemporaneous storytelling style, and together, we're going to try to make sense of the world, all through the art of storytelling, and all in approximately 7 minutes.
He said something that was openly silly. I was like, no, I know that to be wrong. You're wrong. And I said, David, you're wrong. And the whole room, the whole lecture theater went, and this is really culturally typical in Japan. It's very, very rude to disagree with someone. Sarcasm is rude. So large parts of what I perceive to be my personality, which is completely socially unacceptable. In Japan, it was much easier in Shanghai, but there were still aspects where I was like, okay, I need to be very careful about how I explain this because the way I think about it is very Western. And of course, politics is one of those things. Like you can't really be a fire breathing liberal in China. one of the first things they said to me at language school was, now, for the purposes of any of your online activities, for the purposes of any phone calls, Hong Kong is part of China. I was like, okay. I'm like, and so, of course, this is so at the shallow end of what it's like to be a foreigner. And that, like, if you are white, you are likely to have a very nice time being a foreigner in other places. You might struggle, but it is unlikely to be terrible. I've only been thrown out of a grand total of one cafe for being white, and that was in rural Japan. And that's my experience of being a foreigner in a bad way. So I'm very aware that I had the best possible time that you can have. But even in those conditions, it's still very difficult. And you end up sitting at your desk at night going, do I have a personality, or am I just like an amalgamation of stuff that I've heard from my country?
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely something to sit with. And right, I didn't even think of I was truly just so stuck on the idea of like giving up one part of yourself. There is such a big concept of, right, there are visual differences. Everyone from Mars is like 7 feet tall, and yeah, naturalized or not, you're always going to look different. Giving up these parts of your culture. I mean, even the idea after, because of course we avoid spoilers, let people enjoy the plot for themselves. But after January and Gail's very public fight, January can't even get a job in fast food. Like,
no.
There's just all of these kind of preconceptions that are built in such a way that's like, if you take away the current world we're living in, you can still see how some things are always going to happen unless change happens, adjustments happen. Yeah. We recognize that, right? What are we made up of?
Exactly. And I think it really, like, being a foreigner is a really good thing to do, because it makes you analyze what actually is culture and why is it important. And this comes up in the book. Once January and Gail embark on this bananas marriage, one of the things that Gail really insists on doing is making sure that January can hold on to his culture. And at first, January doesn't understand why Gail is doing this. But gradually, he starts to realize that culture is a kind of armor. And if you can be proud of where you're from, rather than ashamed of where you're from, particularly if you've been uprooted and put in a new place, then this is extremely important and beneficial to you.
Now, the marriage of convenience.
We've
danced around it.
Yeah.
Let's get into it. First off, tell me a little bit about creating. Let's go with Gail. We've talked about January a bit. Mm-hmm. You've kind of created this person on the run, but now let's look at his counterpart, his you know, partner in all of this. How did you come up with Gail? What was that? What was your character creation process like in general? And you can kind of speak to your whole history if you'd like, and then we'll dive into the marriage. See, we're almost there.
Absolutely, not a problem. So I really try not to write myself into books, but there is a lot of me in Gail, because they are a ridiculously overeducated person who used to be a university lecturer. And their idea of normal conversation is to have a rant about grammatical gender in Indo-European languages. That is who Gail is. That is also who I am. So there is this core to Aubrey Gail that is extremely close to my heart. However, I don't want anyone to picture me when they're reading about Aubrey Gail. Aubrey Gail is 7.5 feet tall. They are Asian, and they are trilingual in Mandarin, Russian, and English. They are also a billionaire. So imagine somebody incredibly, unbelievably glamorous. Unlike me, I'm like an academia weasel. So that's who Gail is. And they were a really, really interesting person to write, because I think one of the things, again, this is me being British, one of the things that I'm always really aware of in daily interactions is class, because Britain is where we think about class. And one of the really interesting things I find about coming to the States is that you know, I'll talk to people about class, because I'm really interested. And a lot of people say, oh, we don't have that here. And I say, okay, now do me a posh accent, do me a well-to-do accent, and they always sound like somebody in a brownstone in upstate Pennsylvania. And then I say, like, do a hick, like, tell me, show me the accent of somebody who you think is like cheap and rubbish and unworthwhile, and there is an accent that is that, and it's usually southern, and you very quickly understand why people in the south do not like people in the north. So class, we all have class, even if a lot of people in the US think that they don't, they really do. And I think this is something that really informed Aubrey Gail. They are right at the top of the class pinnacle. They are the richest, the most glamorous. They are from generational money to the tune of, you know, billions and billions and billions of dollars. So imagine, you know, like Elon Musk's descendants. That's who Aubrey Gale is. So there's that aspect to them. And although they're very, very clever, they're also very insulated by that class structure. They never actually meet poor people. They never meet people who are just desperate and unhappy for very, very simple reasons to do with money. And one of the things that becomes very clear as they start interacting with January is that although they're a genius, there are just things that they never really thought of because they've never been exposed to them. So they live this life of the most incredible privilege, and they do a really good job of imagining their way out of that sometimes.
And only go as far as they understand.
Exactly. Like, theory will only take you so far. And the actual practical experience of talking to January, who by this point is kind of deep in poverty, is really, really quite revelatory for Aubrey Gale. So they're a really interesting figure. The other thing that I think is really important to do as a writer is always to try and write at least once a year or so from the point of view of somebody who politically completely disagrees with you. So I, for example, am very pro-immigration. I think we should have immigration. I think we should have lots of people coming from unsafe countries to safe countries. And I feel that that's like a basic chivalric duty that rich countries have to countries that are less fortunate. But, and I always say this to my students as well, like, writing is about empathy, right? And you're not being truly empathetic unless you can imagine yourself into the shoes of somebody who totally disagrees with you about everything. And that's who Aubrey Gale is. Like, so for me, nationalism is almost like a filthy word. And it would be very difficult, certainly like in my group of friends, for somebody to come out and go like, oh, you know what? Brexit was a great idea. Kind of. Aubrey Gale is a nationalist. They genuinely believe that the only way for their country to be safe is for their country to be shut off from everywhere else. And it was really interesting to actually treat that with empathy and go, look, I need to stop just like snarling at people for believing what I don't believe and sit down and bother to imagine why people think this. And that's Aubrey Gale. That's what they do.
So it became just as much a challenge for yourself and like a study as it did to create what ends up being like a really impactful character to think differently than yourself.
Yeah, definitely. And I try to take all of my very, very strongly held opinions and go, but how would you just disagree with that? And how would you make it sound reasonable?
Aubrey Gale is presented very reasonably. Their comments and conversations are all logic and reason, and it comes from that kind of posh lineage of like, this is what we're meant to do.
Yeah, very much that. In some ways, they are Spock. They're kind of
yes. There were definite
this is
moments.
Numbers. This makes sense. I don't care about your feelings. That's Gale.
When you said Star Trek in your childhood, I went, okay. Mm-hmm. This check.
Yeah, definitely. And on the flip side of Gale, there's this character called Guang Song, who is the consul, and the point of their character, really, for me, was to interrogate what happens if you take what you believe too far.
It is interesting to kind of try to follow that path and see where you want yourself to land. Is kind of what I think it's a good exercise for everyone to even just, you know, great for writers to learn how to write the opposition, but great for ourselves as listeners and readers to take a moment and just be like, oh, where do I fall? And why does someone think like this? Why? What if someone thought like that? And kind of self-reflect.
Definitely. And I think for you and for me, culturally, taking the other side of the debate for fun, it feels kind of sticky because we associate it with kind of very privileged schools and a way of thinking that will often ignore very, very genuine human suffering and kind of like trivialize that and go, oh, but I can make the opposite argument. I think in its truest spirit, though, doing that, not in a flippant way, but genuinely going, why would somebody else not think this, is a really crucial part of being a functioning adult. But it's particularly a part of being a functioning writer.
If we look at your process, how long did you work on the Mars House?
in one form or another, and bearing in mind that early drafts of particularly kind of sci-fi or fantasy novels, anything that's kind of very big and sprawling, requiring a lot of world building, they don't look like the end product at all. So in one form or another, I've been working on this since about 2016.
Oh,
wow. Yeah. So it actually predates other books by quite a lot.
So you've wanted to do this for a while.
Yeah. And the first time I can remember really starting to write it was when I first moved to Tokyo. So I think that was 2015 or so. Yeah.
Marriage of convenience. Now you've built some like beautiful animosity between these two characters.
Oh, yeah.
And I could talk to you about that all day, but now they are getting conveniently married.
They are.
Tell me about it. Why? How did you know this was your device for this moment of the story?
I honestly can't remember where it came from, but I remember realizing that it was perfect, because what you need when you've got two characters who are kind of in diametric opposition is to find a way that's going to make them bash together. Because normally when people hate each other, There's nothing that forces them to do that. Like they'll naturally just separate out. It's like the wrong ends of magnets facing each other. They're not going to jam themselves together. So I needed some device that was going to put them in the same space all the time in a kind of very high stakes way. So I think a marriage seemed like a really, really good way to do that. I think one of the reasons I was thinking about it is that a lot of Mars culture is based on historical Chinese culture. And I was watching these, because I was learning Mandarin, I was watching these beautiful historical dramas about these like really clever, fierce women who are kind of drafted into these arranged marriages. And I think very slowly that sort of sunk in, and I was like, oh, but there's something very historical feeling about an arranged marriage, or it certainly there is if you live in the UK and you're white at the same time. So that felt like, okay, this is a way to link a very sort of futuristic culture to a culture that I really recognize from the past, and particularly the culture that I was thinking about when I was writing the kind of the intelligentsia culture of Mars, which is very, very, very Chinese. So that was there as well. There's also something, I think, historically about arranged marriage, which is associated with, in Western Europe anyway, with the upper classes. Like, this is a thing that the nobility do. And I really liked the way that felt as soon as I wrote it into the story. Because, so Aubrey Gale is the head of this entity called House Gale, which is kind of like, you know, the House of Tudor. Like it's very rich, it's very powerful. There's all this money floating around. And it is like a super modern mega corporation that runs an energy empire. But I wanted to make it feel like old money, like it had been there forever. And there's something about an arranged marriage that feels very old. So I think there was a lot of that going on. It was also a really good excuse to have like a super amazing, glamorous wedding and to put January in lots of really cool clothes.
Yes. I mean, I loved that.
I love that too.
I mean, an excuse for just getting to imagine so much really cool fashion from the future. Okay, I'm in. Now, see, this is the tough part, because there are so many questions I want to ask you that I can't, because it's just straight up spoiler city. So sure. I'll leave that for another day. But before we go into just some questions from a nosy podcaster, is there anything you'd like listeners to really take away from The Mars House?
So the big thing that I thought about when I wrote it, when I was writing, particularly Aubrey Gale, who is very, very clever, is that I really hope people read Gale and see someone who is a dork, but is also really glamorous and really worthwhile, and whose politics will be terrible for some people, but is who is also a likable person. So what I'm really hoping is that if you read a lot of books because you're super smart, but you feel like you will never be desirable and nobody will ever love you, no, like it's so desirable and so attractive. Like clever is attractive. And I tried to make Aubrey Gale into an attractive genius. They are for you, all of you people who feel like you live in the library and tent. Because that was me when I was a kid as well. They are there for you. They're also there for anyone out there who feels like they don't want to be called he or she, but they don't want that to be strange. They want that to be glamorous and desirable and wonderful. And Gale is for you as well.
Oh, I love that. I love all of that. What a wonderful thing to get to take away from it. Now to go from something so beautifully said to some lighthearted, sillier questions.
Let's do lighthearted and silly. I promise I can do that as well. I won't always just like give the Oxford answer to everything.
Believe me, I know you can, but going from truly that to just like, what are you reading right now?
Okay, that's not a problem.
So what are you reading right now?
I've got it on my desk, actually.
Oh, perfect.
Very exciting. So I don't know if you know about a writer called Stuart Turton.
I sure do.
He's wonderful. So he wrote a little while ago now, Seven and a Half Deaths in the US of Evelyn Hardcastle. What I've got on my desk now is his newest book. It's his third book. It's called The Last Murder at the End of the World. And it's so irritatingly clever that I sent him some Twitter abuse about it. It's really clever. So it's about what has happened to the world in the not very distant future after, for some reason, a terrible fog has descended that just kind of eats anything living. And the last of humanity is just left on this Greek island. And kind of weird things are happening, and then someone dies, and there are so many secrets, and it's so much fun. But the best thing about it is that it is the cleverest version of omniscient narration I have ever seen. So clever. So if that sounds intriguing to any listeners, it's going to be out at the same time as my book, March 2024.
What is the item on the menu that you judge the restaurant by?
That I judge the restaurant by? So I'm actually a bit rubbish at food. I eat garbage. It's really bad. Like my New Year's resolution this year has been to like eat some vegetables sometimes. So I'm really terrible. Like I will literally just like, if I eat out, I am very likely to just get a burger and fries, and it doesn't matter what restaurant I'm in. It will be the same every single time. I mean, most people can make a burger.
pretty hard to screw that one
it's
up.
Usually, I mean, you say that, but in the UK, we can screw up anything culinary. We can make it bland, we can boil it.
TikTok has also shown me the world of Chinese takeaway in the UK.
Oh, it's horrendous. Chinese food here is quite strange, and I think a lot of the time not Chinese. So I ate the best I've ever eaten in my life in Shanghai, and I got so angry, right? Because it cost about $5 to eat really well for a day. And in the UK, for basic groceries, it would be more like $15 because we've got a cost of living crisis and nobody can afford to breathe anymore. But and so when I had like food in Shanghai, and when I went to restaurants, and we would have these like wonderful sweet and sour pork dishes, like beautiful fried rice. And I had a teacher who had been to college in the UK, and he was really funny because he was from Shanghai and spoke Shanghaiese, but in English had quite a strong Essex accent. It was fantastic. And I can't really do it, but he'd be like, "So what is this rubbish that you're calling sweet and sour chicken? We don't have sweet and sour chicken. What even is that?" But yeah, like actual Chinese food is so healthy. It's so good.
I guess in the UK, you could have a pretty screwed up burger. I'll give you that.
Yeah. So like if you're visiting, like don't rely on it. 90% of the time, it'll be fine. But 10%.
I'll stick to my fry ups. I do love a fry up.
Good. That we can do.
I want to be like beans for breakfast, but then you have them and you're like, beans for breakfast.
Yeah, it works. It weirdly works.
I'm not allowed to be mad at it because I enjoyed it so much. Where can the listeners find you online? Or if they want more info, what's the best place?
So this is strange, but actually X or Twitter. It's the only social media account I've really managed to maintain. Instagram scares me and confused me. So I sort of tried once and then ran screaming on the conclusion that I was too old to do that. Like TikTok for the same reason. Like my students use TikTok and I am terrified of TikTok. I don't understand why it's a thing. Like, and remember that I am from the 18th century. So Twitter is enough for me. I do technically have a website, but it's rubbish and I never update it because I don't understand how the internet works. So, but Twitter.
And what is your at on Twitter?
It's Natasha_Pulley.
Thank you so much for taking the time to be here and to chat with me.
Oh, not at all. It's such a pleasure.
Listeners, make sure you pick up The Mars House on March 19th. Follow Natasha on X. And as always, happy reading.
Readers can sample and borrow the titles mentioned in today's episode on Overdrive.com or in Libby. Our library friends can purchase these titles in Marketplace. Professional Book Nerds is proud to be an Evergreen Podcast signature program. To learn about other Evergreen podcasts, visit evergreenpodcasts.com. Our podcast is produced, recorded, and edited by Emma Dwyer and Joe Skelly and presented by Overdrive. To learn more, visit professionalbooknerds.com.
Hey there! I'm Hannah.
And I'm Audrey.
We are a sister filmmaking duo
and co-hosts of Sleepover Cinema,
our show where we analyze the films that created the collective unconscious of the girls, gays, and theys of the late 90s and early 2000s.
Princess Diaries, The Cheetah Girls, Aquamarine, Cinderella, the one starring Brandy.
We haven't stopped thinking about these movies since we first saw them, and we want you to rewatch them
and review them with us.
Are these movies as bad as critics would have us believe?
Do we even care if they are?
We are always unpacking that very question on Sleepover Cinema.
Check out Sleepover Cinema wherever you get your podcasts or at evergreenpodcasts.com.
See you soon.